Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 349 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host, as usual, or is that ad nauseum? Today, my guest is James Grant. James is the co-founder of Georgia Trial Attorneys, a pretty sizable law practice just outside of Atlanta. And James focuses on personal injury, but with a unique kind of aspect of that, as you'll hear, their firm is exclusively devoted to litigating personal injury cases. And so their referral partners are law firms that are doing the pre-lit work who aren't able, for whatever reason, to resolve the case and have to put the matter into suit. And maybe they're not keen on going to court, or maybe they want to just outsource it for strategic reasons. But that's what the James's firm does. They're very successful at it. And so what we're going to talk about is that evolution, how he went from a practicing attorney as a prosecutor, and now how he and his partner have formed this, you know, very successful partnership in trial practice. So without any further delay, here is James Grant. James Grant, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Hey, Neil, thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad you could take a break in your workout schedule, James. Do you go by James or Jimmy?
I go by whatever you call me.
All right. Well, my mother always said, I gave you the name James for a reason, so we'll go with that. James, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Well, my name is James Grant. I am the co-founding partner of Georgia Trial Attorneys, and we are a litigation law firm where we help other attorneys make more money faster and with less stress.
Well, that sounds promising. How can you make other attorneys make more money with less stress?
So the thing that we found is, number one, you have to be a specialist. You know, the thing that I've always seen, whether it's in entrepreneurship or in school, pretty much in any station in life, if you dabble in a little bit of everything, you're an expert in nothing. So My business partner and I, Mark, we have realized, like, you have to be a specialist. And when we started our firm, we were like, all right, we're going to have to pick something. And through the course of trying several different practice areas over our real first year together as business owners, we settled on personal injury. We were both good at it. We enjoyed it. You know, it's a, number one, it's a lucrative practice that gives me the ability to provide for my family and do the things that I want to do with my life. And so coupling all of that together, we're like, great, personal injury is something where we can help a lot of people and do a lot of good. But taking our mantra even further, we're like, there's 10,000 ways that you can have a personal injury case. And one thing that we've seen is a lot of law firms are very good at the hustle market sell. You know, they're great at getting out there. You know, they're networking. They're, you know, selling their services to, you know, groups of people, not just individuals. And they're building these large networks and they're able to get cases. That's obviously the hardest part. And once you master that, there's so much then that goes into the next steps. So a lot of these law firms and law firm owners are great at pre-litigation cases within personal injury. But when it comes to that next stage of litigation, it's not the same. You know, it's kind of like, you know, baseball isn't football and, you know, constitutional law isn't employment law. So like the skill set that you need to establish and run a pre-litigation personal injury practice is not the same skill set or level of resources that you're going to need if that case ends up going to trial. So what we've found is that we are able to market ourselves as other personal injury law firms' litigation department. And you're effectively your outsourced litigation department, and that's all we do. There are other people that claim to say, well, you know, we're going to be your expert litigation partner, but we've taken our mantra of being experts, and that's all we do. We will not market to pre-litigation clients. We will not drive up our referral partners' cost of acquisition, because if I'm actually trying to help another attorney, if I'm trying to help another law firm by streamlining their process and providing quick, efficient, routine litigation services, it's kind of two-faced for me to then also be paying for PPC and be doing all these other marketing campaigns where I'm effectively driving up their competition and competing with them at the same time. So yeah, that's how we're able to help other lawyers make more money faster with less stress by effectively outsourcing their litigation department to our firm.
Yeah, I can definitely vouch for the less stressful aspect of it. It's interesting how, I was just having this conversation with another guest on a previous interview, and it's interesting how in the personal injury world, it's that there's that natural line of demarcation in a case as it transgresses through from start to finish. And that's the division line between pre-litigation and litigation. And oftentimes that, for a full service, not to say that you're not full service, but for a personal injury firm that does all of it from end, that line is oftentimes the line in which the contingency fee goes up X percent prior to having to file a complaint, Y percent after the complaint. I find it really interesting that you picked the second half of that equation. What you said, you found that you were good at it, and it's what you like. I would venture to say 9 out of 10 like the pre-lit.
Oh yeah, I mean, who doesn't? I mean, high margins, like even if your cost of acquisition on a pre-lit litigation case in a saturated market is, you know, $1,800 or $1,900, but your average attorney fee is, you know, 10 to 20,000, like mm-hmm. those are incredible margins. So why wouldn't you want to do it? I get it. That's why there's a lot of people that do pre-litigation and do it very well.
Right. But it, as you say, it is a competitive market, and you know there are a lot of firms that say, hey, we can be your litigation partner, but oh, by the way, we also have our own pre-lit department. We're not giving that, but we'll do your litigation too. And you've differentiated yourself and said, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to compete with you for, you know, client acquisition and drive up the cost of doing so. We're just here to accept litigation cases if you're unable to resolve them without going to trial.
Well, yeah. And I mean, like you said, you know, you got to differentiate yourself, and everyone needs, you know, unique value proposition, but it gets really nebulous when you start talking about, well, you know, our firm just gives better customer service than everybody else. Or you start talking about these like subjective things where everybody's right. Doing the same thing. Whereas I was like, all right, we're actually going to say we're not going to market and drive up your pre-litigation cost of acquisition and compete with you. That's an objective metric that they can see, that we can see, that, you know, anybody can hold us to. Whereas, you know, well, we're the best at communicating with our clients. No one knows what that means.
Yeah, well, we would hope you would be good at communicating with your clients. You know, that's kind of like the minimal, the low bar. You should. Yeah,
that's the minimum barrier to entry.
Exactly. Nobody should have to claim that as a feature. But what I do like also about this is that it gives meaning to your firm name. When you say trial lawyers, you mean that. We're trial lawyers. That's all we do.
Well, I mean, it's part of how, you know, both of us kind of grew up in the legal community. Myself and Mark, you know, I was a prosecutor and he was doing a lot of court-appointed work. And so both of us got a whole lot of trial experience really fast. I think in my
first 2 years. This is a good segue. Let's go back. In law school, do you think you're going to be a trial lawyer?
Woo, no, not a chance. I was a civil engineer. I went to Georgia Tech and I got a civil engineering degree. And I wanted to go to law school because I thought I was going to do one of two things. I thought I was either going to become a patent and trademark lawyer, or I was either going to do environmental law and like work for EPA. That was at least the initial plan.
Let me just stop you right there, Jay. So you're a civil engineer and you decided to take a pay cut to go and become a patent attorney or an EPA attorney?
I mean, I was idealistic in my youth. And you know, things change over time.
Yeah, I'm just I'm being a smart aleck here because civil engineers are really in high demand, particularly around this area. But go ahead. So you weren't thinking trial attorney at all. Tell us how that journey then began.
So, I mean, you know, a lot of the listeners are in the legal profession and went to law school. And, you know, a lot of us know how it works is, you know, generally in your third year, you can, you know, effectively practice law as long as you're supervised through the Third Year Practice Act, or many states call it different things. I was able to do something like that with the local district attorney's office where I went to school.
I did the same thing.
Yeah.
I did the same thing.
And, you know, I was a third year law student and I was trying criminal cases as a prosecutor. It was crazy.
We call it Rule 36 attorney here in Maryland under supervision of a trial attorney. And I was doing, you know, low level criminal prosecution and some juvenile work too.
And I mean, it's a great way for you to get exposure, but you know, the second I got in the courtroom and you find out that what you see on TV and kind of even what you hear in the first couple of years of law school, that's not really how it works.
And not really.
It's not necessarily about what's right and what's wrong and who actually did or didn't do whatever that said. It's who gives the best performance, who's the better salesman, who is the one that can entertain the jury. And that's where I was like, yep, this is my thing.
Yeah, I was kind of the same way. I'm like, because I'm a drama queen. I liked the action of the courtroom. I liked the presentation, the dramatic effect of that until I got outperformed. And I'm like, okay, I'm not as good as I thought I was.
Well, I mean, you know, that also is humbling. You know, when you see another attorney that's either just innately has that skill or they've honed that skill over years and decades, and you just see how they're able to walk into a room and immediately identify with a jury. I mean, that's impressive and it's admirable as well. Like we look up to them.
So that's where you get your start as a student prosecutor. And then when you got out, did you go into the criminal defense world or did you, no, you said you worked at the prosecutor's office.
Yeah. So, I mean, I stuck with what I knew. I you know, came back to Georgia. I went to law school in Alabama. And I came back to Georgia. I was like, you know what? I know how to do this. You know, this is something where you've got to get experience. And the best way to get experience is to let the government pay for it. So, you know, that's what I did for the first 2 years of my career was, you know, tried a whole bunch of cases. Georgia does things very different than a lot of states. We split things up to where the district attorney only handles felonies. And then the solicitor general only handles misdemeanors. So I got a job in the Solicitor General's office, and it was actually more beneficial to me than the district attorney's office, in my opinion, because instead of having a low caseload, I had a super high caseload. I had probably like 400 or 500 cases at any point in time. And I mean, you're just churning and burning and trying cases every single month.
Pretty much every single day, too, or a lot of times. The volume and the pace of that is really something you have to have some stamina for.
Absolutely. But yeah, I mean, I think in the first 2 years of me working there, I think I had in between like bench and jury trials, I had over 30 trials and I had at least 10 jury trials. I mean, I tried more cases in that first 2 years than many tried in their entire career.
For sure. Now, tell me about how you hooked up with your partner. How did you guys know each other and how did you make that decision to strike out on your own?
So after my first 2 years as a prosecutor, you know, it was time. I was like, all right, it's time for me to go into private practice. And I found a firm that did kind of what I called door law. You know, if you came in the door and you had a case, they were going to handle it.
Sure.
Knowing what I know now, probably wouldn't have gone with that because I just didn't understand from a business perspective how problematic that is. But from, you know, my youth and youthful perspective, I was like, this is a great way for me to just get a whole lot of experience in a whole lot of areas, which I did. My business partner now, Mark, he started at that same firm 2 weeks before I did. So he and
go.
I were thrown into it, and it was not the most well-run business. And, you know, we were thrown in, we were doing so many different things. There wasn't really a whole lot of training. There wasn't a whole lot of structure. And it was one of those things where very early on, we kind of looked at each other. We're like, I think we can do this ourselves. We can do it our way, and we can probably do it better. So, you know, we started saving, we started planning, we started putting things in motion. And I think it was 14 months later, so December of 2014, we turned in our notice, and the next day, you know, January 2015, we opened the doors of Georgia Trial Attorneys, and, you know, the saga began.
And so in that runway, that ramp up to opening the door, you made a conscious decision at that point to focus on trial work, or were you still doing a smattering of other things?
So it was one of the deals where, you know, obviously you're starting your own firm, you have bills, and you have to get cases.
Yep.
So we knew personal injury was going to be in that, but you obviously have a ramp up with personal injury cases. I mean, even if I sign a case today, absent it being one of the very few outliers, you know, we've had a few cases where we've settled in, you know, 30 or 45 days, but that is the exception.
Pretty unusual.
Not the rule. Yep. So we were like, we've got to do some other things, at least while we're figuring out how this process is going to work. So we did a little bit of criminal defense. We did a little bit of family law, and we were very heavily focused on personal injury. But probably after a year and a half, we were exclusively a personal injury law firm. And even then, we have been refining into what we are today as far as narrowing down and just, you know, specializing.
Yeah, in those days, you know, because I was in private practice at that time, there weren't some of the options that we have now. So when you say you opened your doors, you literally opened the doors to a new office space, right?
So that's the different thing looking back now. I mean, you know, we're doing this podcast today, and I'm down in my basement office gym, and we have an office space, but no one is there. We have people all across the country and all across the world that work for us. So the level of, you know, diversity we are able to have from a employment and staffing standpoint and location standpoint is so vastly different from the world in 2015, where, yes, you had to have a physical space and everybody was local to your geographic location.
And just to bring that into perspective, we're talking about in one decade. And really, honestly, the latter half of that decade.
Yeah.
You know, it was trending that way in 2014, 15, 16. And then it just really, because of the pandemic, took off like gangbusters. So now the virtualization of a law firm is, you know, an option that people have, or you didn't have it when you opened your doors to start with. You virtually had to have an office.
And I mean, I think that's one of the benefits that we're able to provide, where, you know, not a lot of firms necessarily are able to do that. But clients, at the end of the day, they don't care about your physical location. They don't want to have to take off work to come out and see you and to, you know, walk into your office and shake your hand. Like, everybody's busy. And if we can communicate via text, phone, video chat, you know, there's a multitude of ways now where we have so much more accessibility and so much there's just so many ways that you can look at this and say, all right, how am I going to skin this cat today? Whereas before it was, well, you've got to come to the office.
Yeah. Now, you didn't get there from 0 to 60 in one step. So you have your office and you're starting to gain client, and, you know, you're kind of focusing down on niching to be the litigation partner in PI cases. And I'm guessing that the first few cases that you got were your typical car accident case, premises, liability, slip and fall cases. I don't think some, correct me if I'm wrong, you didn't get one of those home run cases, you know, right from the get-go, right?
Oh, man, I would have loved that. That would have been great to have been able to, you know, get a wrongful death case right off the bat and be able to throw that into marketing and just grow faster. But no, I mean, we had to start, you know, small. You have to earn respect from, yep. I mean, especially in the legal community, you know, and also, I mean, rightfully so, you shouldn't trust somebody that's new just because they have a JD, just because they have a bar license. You know, right. You have to be able to prove and through your experience show that this is my track record. This is what I'm able to deliver. You know, this is the skill set that I bring to the table. And one thing that we've been really big on is, you know, our firm is very, very technology focused. And
well, that was going to be my next point, because in doing so, okay, you had to develop systems and technologies and methodologies as you grew to be able to handle those bigger cases. So tell us a little bit about your technology base and how that, you know, how that expanded and some of your successes and maybe even some of the things that you did that you wish you had done differently in terms of technology and growth.
Well, and it all started from the mindset of we need data. Data is everything. Yeah. And one thing that we've learned through our entrepreneurial journey is as a business owner, you can never make a decision that's based upon your gut or based upon feel or based upon perspective. Because the second you do that, you're just left to a whim. Like you have no foundation. Whereas if you make decisions that are based on data and metrics, you can't go wrong. You know, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, you know, these are guys that are running giant billion-dollar corporations based upon exact and specific metrics and KPIs, not gut and feel. And if they can do it, you can do it for a business that just so happens to practice law. So mm-hmm. when Mark and I realized that this is the way we're going to run our business, we're like, we need a technology platform that is able to deliver that. And I know you're probably not going to like it, but we're big on the PC side of things. We mm-hmm. love Microsoft SharePoint, Microsoft 365. I mean, there's just so many tools and things where we're able to use and track and forecast and have objective metrics for all things because Microsoft really runs the world. And so that's the platform at least we've used to run our firm and base our firm out of.
No, and I get that. The larger the enterprise, you know, I think there's a lot to be said.
If you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast.
As a law firm owner, you take responsibility for driving more revenue for your firm. But how much of that revenue ends up as bottom line profit? Ryan Himmler, the net profit CFO, helps law firms drive more top line revenue to bottom line profit. His two game changing tools are the scorecard, so you can actually know what your numbers are and can make informed decisions, and the action plan, so you know how to get your numbers where you want them to be and drive more net profit. To learn more about Ryan, check out episode 306 of The Law Entrepreneur, and you can get a free profit acceleration call by going to go.oncehub, that's O-N-C-E-H-U-B, go.oncehub.com/profit. I will also tell you, just as an aside, I am a client of Ryan's. I have been working with him for the past 6 months. Frankly, ever since he did that episode with me, I signed on with him to be a client. And I've been thrilled with the kind of information and insight he's been able to give me. So do yourself a favor, you know, get that free call and check out Brian Kimmler at netprofit.com.
Look, I was a Microsoft applications user for a long, long time. And I, you know, their Office productivity apps, I was the Obi-Wan of Microsoft Word and Excel and PowerPoint. So no, I get all that. So how about case management? Because I would guessing, because you use, as you said, a staff now that is spread out across the state, across state boundaries, and even internationally to support the work that you do. You got to have a killer case management tool as a foundation. Am I right?
Yes. It is a beast to be able to, you know, manage and make sure that all the trains run on time and hit their stops in the right order. And a case management system is integral to that. One thing that Mark and I have found is a lot of what is marketed to personal injury attorneys today as case management is not really case management. When we think of case management softwares, we think of calendaring, we think of note taking, we think of, you know, being able to upload documents and track the case. But that's not really case management. That's just data storage. You know, you're just storing data of dates and notes and documents. That's not actually managing anything. So one of the reasons why we also went with Microsoft is there's so many tools that Microsoft has as far as Microsoft Dynamics, Microsoft Power BI. There's so many things where we can build in workflows and automation and processes that just work without human interaction. Because if you can remove human interaction so many times, you remove the chance and propensity for error. So what we have a case management software that we use just as more of a document storage dump area in addition to Microsoft SharePoint, but we have been building our own workflow checklist process that may or may not eventually turn into its own business model as well, but it allows us to control a little bit better and streamline that process so that when we work with other attorneys, we can objectively show with the data and the metrics, you know, this is what our results are. This is how fast we move. This is how things happen. And this is why it happens so fast. And I think that's a better selling point as opposed to saying, well, I have Sally here and Sally's really good at her job and she does these things very well. But the second Sally leaves, then you've got a problem. Whereas building in that automation and those processes and those procedures, it reduces the need for human interaction, but that also makes the case go faster and generally gets you a better recovery.
Yeah, let me see if I can translate that a little bit, because I know you know what it means to your firm. Let me see if I can help with our audience understand. So you have a suite of what I used to call COT software, commercial off-the-shelf software, you know, that's available through Microsoft, and all of their Microsoft branded products work together as you would expect them to. And basically what you've been able to use is to leverage those existing products to create workflows and dynamic processes that are in many cases automated, and they match the way your work is done. It fits the way your work is done. It's not a one-size-fits-all platform. It's a bunch of different pieces that all work together. Is that a fair characterization?
Correct. And I mean, I'll give you a simple example, but, you know, a simple example is, you know, a certain document comes in, and the only position that we have in our entire firm that is actually in the office a couple days a week is our receptionist. That's the one thing we haven't been able to figure out yet, is how to entirely do away with mail, just because with a personal injury firm, you're dealing with checks in addition to, you know, other mail. So it's not as practical to have an outside mail service also handle your checks just from a security standpoint. So that's our one part-time position that we have. But when a document is scanned into our system, we have built-in workflows to where that document is OCR'd or it's, you know, made readable so that it can be searchable. And then depending on certain characters that we flag as high priorities or other workflows, it's then named according to our certain naming convention. And then depending on that naming convention, then other tasks and things are done, whether it be deposited into a certain folder, forwarded to a client, forwarded to an attorney or a paralegal. And then also, you know, does it contain this, like if it's an answer, is this affirmative defense contained in there? Okay, if this affirmative defense is contained in the answer, has this been accomplished? Has this been accomplished? Okay, then go to the next step. So a lot of these things that you would pay, you know, a $30, $40, $50 an hour employee to do are done automatically, and there's a lot lower risk of being missed. So it's able to streamline the process, because with personal injury litigation, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, and we like to be as squeaky and loud as possible.
The real key there, and I don't want to bury the lead, but the real key there is your file naming convention.
Oh, yeah. We've probably gone through like 12 different iterations of what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah. David Sparks, who was a guest on the show a long, long time ago, who is the host of a very popular podcast called Mac Power Users. Now, you know, all things Apple is an Apple podcast. But he's an attorney, although he's now retired as an attorney, and he's focusing on his work as an advocate and a content creator for all things Apple related. But anyway, he long ago in his book called His Field Guide, Paperless, identified the file naming convention as the single most important decision that a business, and particularly a law firm, can make. How that works, because one, just as you said, once you've name the file according to your convention, then you have systems that look at that file name, and based on that file name and the content of the file that it is, can make this just exactly how you said, decisions on to whom does that go, what matter does that get attached to. You have all these conditional questions and decision points that are strung together to create the workflow. And it automates the whole process. Now, it's a challenge to build. And, you know, you didn't build it in one fell swoop. I'm certain, as you said, you reiterated, revised your naming convention a few times. I'm sure the whole process is under continual evolution, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, and, you know, even though I went to Georgia Tech, I am not a computer science guy. My business partner, Mark, he gets more of that. So he's able to help us with the workflows. But I mean, even just doing simple things of making sure that every single process does not die, making sure that building out and mapping out the workflow, you know, in writing first to make sure that every step, no step dies. You know, it has somewhere to go, even if it goes back to the beginning for a certain step, but making sure that the loop is never left open. You always close the loop for every single process.
That's, well, as you know, that's just good systems engineering.
Yeah.
Right. You have to have that. Let me shift just a little bit then, because trial work is your bread and butter. Going to trial. I'm sure that you've seen tremendous growth in the use of technology in court. Tell me about your approach to technology in the courtroom.
There are a lot of ways to use technology. I huff because we kind of go back and forth. It really just... it depends on the case. It depends on the jury. It depends on the court. I mean, there are so many factors where we can't really have, you know, this is the technology vendor we're going to use, or these are the specs that we're going to request for, you know, every single trial, because everything needs to be tailored to, you know, the case and the client and really the jury pool, because, you know, it doesn't necessarily matter who my client is, who I am, who the defense attorney is, who the judge is. It's more about who are those 12 jurors that are going to be hearing and making the decision. Can I pitch to them? And so a lot of things that we'll look at is, you know, well, where are we going to be? And is the jury panel going to be accepting of technology? Are they going to understand the technology? Is that going to be too overwhelming for them? I mean, sometimes also, you know, we'll try to come in there and do something different. You know, we can do a trial where we're not going to put up any medical bills. We're not going to submit a single medical bill to the jury and just do a trial on pain and suffering. Well, then it kind of reduces the need for technology other than the fact we may be showing some videos. We may be showing some day in the life videos. But other than that, you know, we're trying to make this in and out to not give the defense a whole lot to poke holes in. It's just, hey, this is the story. Let's let our attorneys be storytellers and not having to use technology, because sometimes technology fails. And then when technology fails, then, you know, the jury's looking at you like, what are you going to do now?
Yeah, well, you're right. Every case is different and every jurisdiction is different. Some jurisdictions are more open to it than others. You know, and I won't characterize them by.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I'm excited about, we haven't had the opportunity yet, but in some of our major metro Atlanta area courts, they're doing jury selection virtually. I'm still on the fence. I'm still on the fence about it. I don't know whether I think it could be good or bad, but I'm curious to try it just to see whether you get more information or not. I mean, I've seen some, you know, some videos and some, you know, you're able to watch online, so to speak, but, you know, maybe that helps with jury selection by being able to see inside a person's home and see who they are in their house, as opposed to what facade they're putting on in court.
Well, is that just the addressing the need that we don't want to bring 400 people into the courtroom in this day and age? We want to select the juries outside of the courthouse and only bring the selected jurors in. Is that the impetus for that?
I think so. I mean, originally it started with, you know, we had COVID and we still wanted to try to move cases. So even when the lockdown stopped, they were like, all right, we're going to try this jury selection thing virtually and then bring those 12 jurors in and space them apart. But I think some of the judges are saying, well, why don't we just do this all the time? And then it allows a lot more flexibility. Also, too, I think it's a good political pitch for the judges, because they can say, hey, you know, we introduced this thing that's not near as inconvenient, because if you don't get called or you get struck for cause, well, you just shut down your computer and then either go physically to work or you open your computer back up and you start work right there, as opposed to having to be in court, get out, drive back. And
I like that. I like that. I'll be interested to see what your views are as that moves forward. I mean, I freely admit, when I was litigating, I always thought half of all the hearings that I went to could have been done, you know, via Zoom. And we didn't have Zoom at the time. But I knew there was a lot of things we could have done either over the phone or in other ways. And now they're routinely being done that way. So, and it sounds like jury selection is kind of moving in that same direction.
I mean, it's definitely interesting to see how the legal community at large has changed as a result of being thrown into the pandemic and having to adjust and having to pivot and having to use technology. I think it only stands to benefit the legal community as well as the litigants.
Yeah. Well, and that's a pretty good area for us to kind of wrap up here by looking ahead. You know, somebody like yourself, your firm, which only does litigation, and you practice throughout just the state of Georgia, or you remind me, are you multi-jurisdictional?
So we work with other law firms across the Southeast. They're, you know,
there are a lot of states that, you know, are close to Georgia, and there's a lot of people that travel through Georgia. So, I mean, we work with a lot of firms in Georgia and outside of Georgia to handle Georgia cases. That is where we are today. But as you said about going into the future, we've got some pretty big plans, and we see this service being something that can be offered and afforded to a national audience.
It's not that far-fetched to envision Georgia trial lawyers being also, you know, the Alabama trial lawyers in nearby jurisdictions. It sounds like it's something that with some work you can replicate. So is that a vision that you're looking at?
Yes. And I mean, the only thing that we really have to focus for our brand is making sure that we bring those highly skilled litigating attorneys in the air, because we can run a lot of the processes here in Georgia with our team, whether it be, you know, our team that's in Georgia or in this country or across the world, how we have it structured. But, you know, having those local attorneys do help. And that's why I think we're looking to make sure we find those first and then build the team around them, because effectively they're going to be the superstars and we want to support them with a strong cast.
Sure. Well, listen, James, this has been great. I've been really interested in hearing your approach to the practice of law and how your firm has grown and realized its vision. Tell our audience, what's the best way for somebody to reach out to you if they have questions to ask or maybe want to connect with you for any other reason?
Best way to check us out is on our website. It's our toll-free number. It's all the same. It's 833-4-THE-WIN. That's 833-4-THE-WIN.com. You can check out our website. We've got a bunch of free resources as well. You know, our thought is a rising tide raises all ships. So a lot of our templates, a lot of our, you know, samples are on our website, free for download for anyone, whether you're an attorney or not, because if it's helped us, we hope that it can help you. And if you have questions about it, we're here to answer them just the same.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I forgot to take note of that. One of the things I really liked about the website is your resources page. And I think that's to be commended, your approach to helping everybody else. As you said, the rising tide lifts all boats. So I'm glad you mentioned that, and people should take the opportunity to go check that out.
Absolutely. And if anybody has any questions, you can find me on the website. You know, you can look us up. You can give us a call. I'm happy to talk. I'm happy to help anyone that's out there.
All right, James. Well, thanks so very much. And next time I'm down in Hot Atlanta, I'll come look you up.
Absolutely. We'll go play a round of golf.
That's a good idea. All right. Take care. Thanks for being a guest on The Law Entrepreneur.
All right. Thanks, Neil.
Well, there you have it, boys and girls. Another episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors for this episode. Our good friends at Ruby. I can't say enough about Ruby. As you know, they've been my virtual receptionist for years now. Couldn't be happier with them. And I really urge all of you, if you need a virtual receptionist, that you give Ruby a chance. Also, Net Profit CFO, as I've mentioned before, Ryan Kimler was a guest on the program some time ago. I liked what he had to say so much, I became a client. And then after I became a client, he became a sponsor. So very happy about that arrangement. If you want to take your understanding of your financials in your law firm to that next step beyond just what your bookkeeper gives you back, give Ryan a call at Net Profit CFO. I don't think you'll be disappointed. If you enjoyed this podcast, do me the great favor of leaving a positive rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. It really helps with the opportunity for us to get in front of other people. And until next week, I wish you all the best, and we'll see you again here on Law Entrepreneur.